The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off in the wellness section of Oprah Daily. Is creatine the midlife wonder supplement you're missing? Long used by bodybuilders to bulk up, this compound may strengthen and sharpen your brain, too. And this article is by Florella Valdesolo. When Laura Taft, 62, first started supplementing with creatine at the suggestion of her trainer, it was with her muscles in mind. "I wanted to resist bone density loss as I age," says the Brooklyn resident. But within a few weeks of taking creatine daily, Taft clocked a benefit that she hadn't anticipated, a cognitive one. "In addition to strength building, creatine has been really helpful with lifting my brain fog," she says. The best evidence of that, she adds, may be that she remembers to take it every day. Taft's experience reflects a broader shift in creatine's target audience. Once a word rarely heard uttered outside of powerlifting circles, nowadays creatine is attracting new interest among women, and middle-aged women at that. According to doctors, it's for good reasons. What is creatine anyway? Creatine is a natural compound that our bodies make using three amino acids, arginine, glycine, and methionine, says Banifesh Bayati, MD, a board-certified OBGYN and medical co-founder of Parallel, and that's P-E-R-E-L-E-L, Health. Its main job is to help make ATP, the body's main source of energy, in muscle and brain tissue, Bayati explains. Creatine is produced in your liver, kidneys, and pancreas, and the majority of it, around 95%, is stored in our skeletal muscles, says Stacy Ellery, Ph.D., a pregnancy physiologist and research group head of biogenetics in reproduction at the Hudson Institute of Medical Research in Australia. But while the body may naturally produce creatine, that amount covers only a portion of what your muscles use, particularly if you're active or working on building them, says board-certified OBGYN Mary Claire Haver, MD. And though creatine is also found in animal-based foods like red meat, poultry, and fish, for your body and brain to really reap the benefits, you'd need to eat a few pounds a day, hence supplements. How creatine helps muscles. In the 90s, supplementing with creatine rose to popularity among the bodybuilding masses, as did the first wave of scientific studies supporting its ability to bolster muscle mass. How does it do it? Creatine phosphate stored in muscles is responsible for supplying energy for quick anaerobic bouts of muscle contraction, says Heather A. Milton, an exercise physiologist supervisor at NYU Langen Health. "We use those CP stores within 10 to 30 seconds," she adds. "So the higher the stores we have in the muscles, the more our energy output. This means creatine provides more capacity to lift a heavier load and withstand fatigue while doing so, and that increased strength of work produces greater muscle growth," says Milton. "So you're able to train harder, lift heavier, and crucially recover faster. Because creatine is key both for muscle metabolism and muscle repair. But it's important to remember that taking creatine alone won't magically grow your muscles. It's the increased capacity to train that most people experience when taking creatine that results in increased muscle mass and exercise performance," says Ellery. How the rest of your body may benefit. While the research on creatine and muscle is long-standing and robust, newer research points to additional benefits. One area is the brain, which makes sense considering that the brain relies on ample amounts of ATP, which, as a reminder, creatine helps create, to function. When creatine stores are low, brain cells may have a harder time keeping up with the energy demands of thinking, processing information, and managing stress, says Haver. Thus far, says Bayati, studies have shown creatine to be beneficial for cognitive function in stressful situations or with sleep deprivation. Another area of research growth is reproductive health. Estrogen levels affect creatine metabolism and play a role in both the synthesis and bioavailability of creatine, says Bayati. This is why creatine levels fluctuate with your menstrual cycle and other hormonal changes, like the drop in estrogen during menopause. Not to mention that key players in the reproductive process, sperm, uterus, placenta, and fetus, rely on creatine as a source of cellular energy. Observational studies suggest that in some cases, low creatine levels are associated with fertility complications and adverse pregnancy outcomes, says Ellery. Why women in midlife may be the biggest winners. Creatine is not a one-size-fits-all recommendation for every woman hovering around midlife. But most doctors agree that, besides vegans and vegetarians who noticeably lack it in their diets, middle-aged women stand to benefit from it because it can help mitigate the loss of muscle and bone mass, as well as the brain fog that is common in perimenopause. The fact that creatine not only increases exercise performance, but also specifically targets changes in energy metabolism, inflammation, and oxidative stress associated with insufficient estrogen is huge for women in midlife, says Ellery. She adds that creatine is also fast becoming a therapeutic intervention of interest for diseases more prevalent in female populations, such autoimmune and major depressive disorders. For Virle Arts, that's V-E-E-R-L-E, a 39-year-old strength and mobility coach and co-founder of Brooklyn Athletic in Brooklyn, New York, a podcast interview with Stacey Sims, Ph.D., talking about creatine in the context of women's health and performance benefits first piqued her curiosity. After taking it for 4 weeks, I began to notice that I could scale up my workouts and sustain a higher intensity. Around the 6-week mark, I felt clearer, like my brain fog had lifted. And 2 months in, I had noticeably put on more muscle, says Arts, adding that she has been taking it for 10 months and has no plans to stop. Most of my female clients over 40 are either considering creatine or already taking it. Are these supplements safe? Creatine's use as a dietary supplement has been studied for decades, and it is widely regarded as safe. In the 90s, it got some negative press due to a case study linking it to kidney injury, says Ellery, but that study has since been debunked and superseded by thorough safety reviews. Still, people with kidney issues should check with their doctors before taking the supplement. Because the supplement market is widely unregulated, paying attention to source and quality are key, says Milton. Creatine monohydrate is the gold standard, says Haver. Specifically, products that are third-party tested, like those certified by the Clean Label Project for purity, potency, and contaminants, the clinically effective dose that doctors usually recommend is 3 to 5 grams a day. Though people who are keen to saturate their muscles faster, says Haver, will sometimes creatine load, which involves taking a higher dose, 20 grams per day, split into 4 doses for 5 to 7 days. But that isn't necessary, especially if you're in this for long-term health and maintenance. Consistency matters more than anything else, and as with any supplement, it's important to note that there is a range of responsiveness. Some people experience mild side effects like water retention or gastrointestinal upset, and some people experience a benefit while others don't. Additionally, many doctors recommend taking it for up to 5 years, since its effects beyond that time frame are not well documented. The bottom line, for women eager to shore up their mental and physical strength in midlife, it may be worth trying. We've moved over to the lifestyle section. The future of travel is emotional. Tom Marchand, the co-founder of luxury travel company Black Tomato, dares us to ditch the bucket list and follow our feelings instead. The expert is in. For almost two decades, Black Tomato has been redefining luxury travel, and not by offering the lavish resorts or five-star amenities so often prioritized by the industry, but by curating deeply personal and emotional-driven experiences for its clients. As an antidote to perfunctory bucket list travel, the company has built its philosophy around the pursuit of feeling that we find while traveling, but not in our everyday lives. Travel can feel transactional, but Black Tomato co-founder and luxury travel expert Tom Marchand is determined to make travel as personal as possible, one experience at a time. Here he shares insight into his company, the industry, and the transformational impact of travel. You've built Black Tomato around the idea of emotional travel. How did that concept first come to life? Why did you choose to categorize experiences by feelings as opposed to destinations? In the beginning, many of our friends and colleagues didn't know where they wanted to travel, but they knew how they wanted to feel. There are lots of destinations and things to do in the world, but travel hadn't quite been brought to life in a way that focused on feeling. Even before we started the company, we would go off in pursuit of feelings and emotions. When we launched the company, we didn't list any destinations. Everything was categorized according to emotional need. It was a totally different way of looking at it. It was also in the days when the word experience was not nearly as ubiquitous as it is now. Oftentimes, our job is to ask the questions that people are asking of themselves. It's almost like being a therapist. Some other companies make it quite easy by going for a short-term sale. With us, we like to ask our clients what it is they're really looking for. What place will make you feel inspired, feel challenged? As such, the pursuit of feeling has always been a part of our DNA, because in life, whether through travel or not, emotional well-being has become super important. How exactly does your pursuit of feeling platform work? What role does AI play in shaping your travel recommendations? Our whole idea is that your travel and your body keep the score. We've been working on our pursuit of feeling platform for a long time. There, we've created many travel experiences and sorted them according to key emotional categories. Being revitalized, challenged, contented, or distracted, for example. You can interact with and search these categories in a really interesting way. In terms of AI technology, AI has become the language of business, hasn't it? Our whole goal here is to enhance the customer experience. We want to celebrate the best of our human insight and passion. Our AI tech can smooth the process. It pulls from our own data, from our own trips and insights. So it's not something that's going out into the vastness of the internet and gathering random information. We call it our feeling engine. You can have a conversation with our AI about how you want to feel on your trip, and it will come back to you with suggestions and direct you to an experience that will best embody that feeling. And then, of course, we'll put you in touch with our human experts to bring it all to life. You've spoken about travel as a form of self-discovery. Can you share a personal experience in which travel allowed you to shed personal or societal expectations? Our customers don't necessarily want to go places just because people are talking about them. It's with the rough and ready stuff where you're going to have the best memories, the best experiences, and the best lens into a place. I remember being in Delhi once, and my guide kept asking where I wanted to go. I said, "Just take me to where you would like to go, okay?" At first, he pulled up outside the Oberoi Hotel, and I said, No disrespect, but no thanks. Then we ended up going on this rickshaw right into the guts of Old Delhi. There's this tiny hole in the wall with clay oven cooking and the best tea in the world, and it's where his mother's best friend had been working for decades. We just sat there together. It was dreamy. This is what people actually want, regardless of level. Feeling of discovery, of living like a local. It's so lucky to be able to dip into the world and see it as it is, and there's so much more reflection in a place like that than, say, a fancy restaurant or hotel. I know we're all very fortunate to have those restaurants, but they tend to blur after a while. You could be anywhere, you know? Many travel experiences today can feel overly curated. How do you ensure that the trips you design retain an element of spontaneity and genuine discovery? About 5 years ago, we launched a service called Bring It Back, which was the creation of a series of inspirational itineraries. This service was where you would travel and spend time with different communities just to get an alternative take, from nomadic tribes in Mongolia to entrepreneurs in Iceland. And you bring everything you learn back home, even if it's something you didn't necessarily agree with or something that would challenge your view. When we think about wellness, it's often very personal. It's always been a big believer of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and was looking at the way you journey through those needs, especially with self-actualization. What you know, how you feel fulfilled, and the values within yourself. It's not defined by others. Travel is a wonderful vehicle to answer questions that you might have about things that are fundamental in your day-to-day, but you don't really get a chance. It might be a relationship, or health, or love, or business, but it's hard to find the answers, except when you travel. You can so often find inspiration from others. When we launched Bring It Back, it was well received, but I think we're still catching up. We're always looking for growth, looking to be challenged, and it's possible to lose sight of what travel can do for you beyond letting you recharge and relax. So, beyond letting you recharge and relax, what does travel really do for you? Ego dissolution travel, when you feel invisible in a culture, is amazing. I often talk about the pursuit of anonymity. You're not important, and it's great. In fact, it's one of the best things in the world. I remember before I started Black Tomato, I was working in Warsaw. There, I saw people wearing these hats, Baker Boy caps. This was before Peaky Blinders got popular. And I really liked them. I started wearing that cap around too, and no one looked at me twice. It was great. Then, when I came back to London and wore it around my friends, they all had such a strange reaction. So strange that I didn't quite have the courage to keep wearing it. That all said, travel gives you a chance to do new things, to learn and to be inspired, to allow your barriers to come down. In other words, it gives you permission to be yourself, even if that's as simple as wearing a Baker Boy cap. We've always aspired to lead our customers to a place they want to be in anyway. It can be hard to find a way there without guidance. People can miss out. There's always a better or more profound experience to be had. But travel is not always about epiphanies or transformations. Some of the best things I've had while traveling are the things that have scared me in the moment. It's about the things that challenge you, that overwhelm you, that are unexpected to you. It's about the whole full range of feelings. We're over in books. Read the steamy excerpt from Alex Astor's Summer in the City. The internationally best-selling author of the Light Lark series makes her adult debut with a lovers to enemies, back to lovers, romance that will melt away even the most persistent winter blues. This article is by Alex Astor. After her debut, YA fantasy book Light Lark was rejected by 16 publishers, Alex Astor took to social media to pitch the story, and instantly went viral. Before the first book was even published, Astor signed a 7-figure film deal with Universal to adapt Lightlark into a major motion picture with the producers of Twilight. The series has since spent 100 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, sold more than 2 million copies in the U.S. alone, and earned Astor a place on Forbes' 2023 30 Under 30 list. Today, the record-breaking Colombian-American author is yet again venturing into unknown territory with the release of her first adult novel, a romantic comedy romp following a 20-something screenwriter who moves to Manhattan to stave off her writer's block, only to realize that her next-door neighbor is the so-called billionaire bachelor she hooked up with in a staircase 2 years ago and has despised ever since. In this exclusive excerpt, the two finally come face-to-face in yet another staircase, as fate would have it. Will sparks fly? Read on and find out. I'm awoken by blaring, flashing lights. I pop one eye open and wonder if I'm in some sort of fever dream, before being told by a sleek, modern robot voice to make your way to the nearest exit. Do not take the elevators. This is a fire alarm. I'm instantly on my feet and my stomach cramps. Maybe that milkshake and fried chicken sandwich weren't such a great idea. I panic because I have anxiety, and this is about the worst possible situation I can imagine. The inexplicably start feeling myself up to see what I'm wearing instead of just looking down. A tank top and sleep shorts. That's fine. It's probably a million degrees outside. The robot tells me to get out of my unit, and I do, before rushing back. My baby! I grab my laptop off the kitchen counter, shove my phone under my armpit, slide my feet into worn tennis shoes, and throw myself into the hallway. The robot is louder out here, and so is the blaring. I find the emergency exit stair entrance, then shoulder it. The door slams into something solid. A person. Not just any person. I stand frozen in the doorway, clutching my laptop to my chest, my face illuminated by the no doubt unflattering flashing emergency lights. It's him. Parker. And we're back in a stairwell. Elle, he probably doesn't remember you. Penelope's low voice in my head, and she's right, even now, not soaking wet from the train, his eyes don't widen with recognition. He doesn't ask me if we've met. He just glances at my laptop and frowns. You're going to carry that down 60 flights of stairs? 60? I manage to completely forget how high up we were. I let out a laugh that sounds half-crazed, especially echoed through the stairwell. Nope, I say, shouldering the door back open. I'll take my chances with the fire. His arm juts out and catches the door. You can't just go back to your apartment. It's probably a false alarm. And if it isn't? I cross my arms around my laptop, annoyed. You were just standing here. You clearly were weighing your options before I came along. He glares at me, and I would be a liar if I didn't admit that it makes my stomach sort of flip. His eyes are unfairly green. A color I can't imagine being able to have on my face. Now that you're here, I can't in good conscience let you go back inside, in case this is a real fire. How heroic. Are you going to carry me down 60 flights of stairs, too? Because I haven't done a minute of exercise since 10th grade P.E., so chances are the stairs would take me out before the fire did. His gaze slides down my body for just a moment before meeting mine again. And for that just a moment, it feels like he might be checking me out. Really? He says, half bored, half unbelieving. I think about what Penelope said about the Pilates body, then shake it off. No, he's not admiring my non-exceptional body in this tank top that now seems way too scandalous to be wearing outside, and the shorts I've had since freshman year of college. He probably flirts with anything with a pulse. If all those paparazzi photos outside of clubs are any indication. He's never been photographed with the same woman twice. Not that I read those articles. I force myself to form the biggest scowl imaginable and sigh. You know what? I warned you, I say, and push past him down the stairs. I wasn't lying. My physical exercise for the last few years has mainly consisted of me walking 7 steps to my Breville coffee machine, 5 steps to the bathroom, or 4 steps to my bed to take a mid-afternoon nap. Penelope once checked my phone's health app and said, "Elle, you averaged 9 steps this week. Apple probably thinks you're dead." It's descending. It can't be that bad. After 3 flights, I'm bent over, heaving like I've run a marathon. I'm convinced he has passed me and climbed down by himself, but when I finally open my eyes, I see him standing there, leaning casually against the wall, like there isn't a blaring fire alarm still going off. "You aren't kidding." I shake my head, breathless. Why would I joke about having a body completely devoid of muscle? All he does is stare down at me, 2 piercing green eyes taking me in like I'm a line of code waiting to be deciphered. Then he stretches out his hand. For a moment, I think he's offering to hold my hand or give me a piggyback ride or something equally and completely unappealing, but then he scowls at my horrified expression and says, "Your laptop?" I clutch it to my chest and turn away from him like he's some sort of thief. "No." He frowns.
"No?"
"No, I can carry it."
"I absolutely cannot. The extra weight is making this descent unbearable."
He looks at me incredulous.
"Do you think I'm going to steal it?"
I shrug.
"I don't know."
He lets out a startled laugh. A moment later, his face is back to its favorite stormy expression.
"I have plenty of laptops, so as nice as those stickers are..."
I immediately regret the 12 different illustrations of coffee that decorate my laptop's entire top.
"I don't need yours."
He stretches out his hand again. "Fine." I hand it over and add, "It has a bunch of encryptions and stuff, so even if you wanted to, you couldn't use it." My laptop has no such thing. Though, honestly, it probably should. The laptop looks laughably small against his side when it took up almost my entire torso.
"Does it now?" he says slowly,
as if he couldn't break all my imaginary encryptions in 5 seconds if they truly existed. He graduated top of his class at Stanford and was so good at coding that the U.S. government hired him when he was in high school. Not that I've looked at his Wikipedia page or anything. We walk in silence, and I'm impressed that I make it 10 more flights of stairs before I lean against the wall, gripping my side. "Oh, go without me," I say, really meaning it. "Save my laptop. That's important stuff on there." He tilts his head at me.
"Then I guess you should probably make it out of the stairwell, since no one will be able to crack your bunch of encryptions."
I glare at him and his tone. Then I groan, "Ugh. I shouldn't have eaten that milkshake and fried chicken sandwich."
"Was that English?"
I say, wincing, "I shouldn't have eaten that milkshake and fried chicken sandwich." There's a pause. Then,
"I'm pretty sure you drink a milkshake, not eat it."
I shake my head, still folded over. "Nope. I eat mine with a spoon. It's 10 times more enjoyable and lasts way longer." I almost feel his eyes on me, but mine are scrunched closed in pain. The cramp in my side feels like being stabbed by an entire knife block. "Go," I groan. "Seriously, it would be a shame for the world's billionaire count to go from 2,668 to 2,667. A moment of silence.
2. "You know who I am?"
"Of course I do," I say, my tone grating, reminded again of the fact that he doesn't remember meeting me. "Your face is on every magazine right now." I peer at him over my shoulder. "Sorry, was I supposed to bow in your presence, congratulate you on your exit, pitch you my startup? I don't know the rules." I think I see the sides of his mouth twitch, but no, that must be an illusion, because a moment later he's frowning again.
"What's your name?" he demands.
"Why?"
"You know mine. It only seems fair I know the name of the person I'm going to die in a stairwell with."
I roll my eyes. "We're not going to die." There isn't a whiff of smoke, and there are only a few people in the stairwell below.
meaning most residents have decided to stay in their units. They're probably smart enough to call the doorman downstairs and ask if it's a false alarm. It's L.
Like the magazine?
I raise an eyebrow. You know what L is?
They put me on some ridiculous list.
I remember the list now because I actually read L, and because, yes, I've read every article that mentions him. They'd put him on a list of most eligible billionaire bachelors. It's probably how he got his nickname.
Come on, L, he says,
and my traitorous body seems to curl at the way he says my name.
Do it for your child, I mean the laptop, he adds,
holding it up in one hand. The other he reaches out to me. For a few minutes I just glare at it. I remember the words he said to me that one night. I think about the fact that he doesn't even remember that night, when it's haunted me for years.
I can buy anything I want.
He implied I would go home with him because of his money, that I would be impressed instead of repulsed by his utter arrogance and presumption. You hate him, you hate him, you hate him. Just then the blaring comes to an end. Thank you, universe, I say, before making my way to the closest door. I shove it open and am happy to be out of the stairwell, away from him.
Forgetting something?
I turn around to see him offering my laptop. I take it, probably more forcefully than I need to, before mumbling a half-baked, thank you. We take the elevator back up to our floor, and I don't even look in his direction before rushing into my unit and slipping back into the comfort of my bed. The book that accompanies this article is Summer in the City by Alex Astor. It's $20 at Amazon, $26 at Bookshop, and $20 at Walmart. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're in relationships now. The three golden rules for starting a tough conversation. These tips from Jefferson Fisher's new book will change your life, especially number three. This article is by Jefferson Fisher. How you handle a difficult conversation says more about your character than the content of the conversation itself. Whether it's breaking up with a significant other, firing an employee, talking about finances, or addressing the elephant in the room, how you enter the conversation is the most important part. If you come in too hot and heavy-handed, the other person will withdraw and get defensive. Me? What about you? If you come in too soft and unassuming, they'll become suspicious of your motives. What are you trying to say? And if you're too passive and shy, they might just run right over you. I'm not listening to this. The best time to remove the difficult from a difficult conversation is before it even starts. Here are three rules to ensure that your approach lands smoothly every time. Number one, set aside real, undistracted time. If you're going to have a difficult conversation, remove any external factors that make it more difficult. Find a private and comfortable setting. Choose a time when neither of you is rushed or stressed, and eliminate any potential interruptions. When you force conversations to happen within your time frame, the other person often goes into it unwillingly from the outset. It's like driving at 70 miles per hour on a highway, only to have a slower car merge right in front of you, forcing you to put on your brakes. Now, swap roles. There are few things more frustrating than when someone tries to force you into a conversation you're not ready for. You'll feel pressured and more prone to stress responses. Instead, set an assigned time in the future to have the discussion. The next time you need to schedule a talk, try this. When would be a good time? Friday morning to go over? Do you have a window around 1:45 on Tuesday to discuss? Do you have capacity to talk about Monday's meeting agenda this afternoon? Make sure the time you've set aside is undistracted. Don't have your phone on your desk. It doesn't count if it's face down. Don't hold your phone in your hand. It doesn't count if you're not looking at it. Send the message that what you have to discuss is your singular focus. Number two, drop the pleasantries. When the topic of conversation is truly a touchy subject or will be received as bad news, we're tempted to create a soft atmosphere. This typically starts by talking about the other person's day or their family.
or by drumming up some random topic you've never taken any interest in before. Do you garden? Womp. You think you're making things better. But people are smarter than that. Despite your incredible acting skills, people have an innate ability to sense a threat. Something feels off. A moment of insincerity from you and the other person will immediately put up their guard. Instead, be direct and transparent from the outset. Begin the conversation by telling them what kind of conversation they're about to have. For bad news, try this. This is going to be hard to hear. I have something uncomfortable to share. This isn't going to be easy to talk about. A simple, this is going to be a difficult conversation works well, too. These types of statements should be the very first thing out of your mouth, or at a minimum, they should follow you saying, thank you for making time to talk with me. This type of approach is more open and honest, and yes, even though it feels more uncomfortable or distressing, it's kinder. Number 3, begin with your end. Lead with your takeaway. In other words, imagine that you're giving a presentation, and you get to the end, the part where you say, in conclusion, move everything after that to the front of your conversation. Let's assume you're in a meeting and giving out this idea. Okay, so you know how we all want customers to feel comfortable once they get to the front desk. So I was thinking, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but too often we get into the whole concept of overcomplicating the customer's experience, which is essentially just the idea that people don't know what they want, right? I say all that to say we should totally simplify our approach and focus on creating a more welcoming environment in the lobby from the moment they enter. Can you see how you don't really know where it's going or what the ultimate ask will be until you're at the end? Let's see what it looks like when you move the end to the beginning. We should create a more welcoming environment for the lobby. If we make the entrance an inviting space, customers will be more likely to be comfortable by the time they get to the front desk. That's it. You've immediately made your point and you've given your reasoning. This technique works with written communication and text messages too. Now imagine you have to turn down an invitation to a party. Which rejection sounds better? Text 1. Hey, okay, so I'm so sorry, but I've just had so much to do today and I've been so stressed. Turns out my dog had an allergic reaction to something and he's acting strange. I'm worried about him. I feel so terrible, but I may not be able to make it tonight. Thank you so much for thinking of me, and if things change, I'll definitely let you know. Text number 2. I got bad news. I can't go tonight. Thank you for the invite. Hope it's a great time. Text number 1 sounds disingenuous. The more words you have to use, the more you sound like you're lying. You'd likely get a snarky text back of, just tell me you don't want to come. Text 2 gets straight to the point, making it sound more honest. It's a response that respects both you and the other person, and ultimately, that's the goal of any conversation. The book that accompanies this article is The Next Conversation, Argue Less, Talk More. It's by Jefferson Fisher, and it's $22 at Amazon and $30 at Target. This is from Culture and News. Gayle King is going to space next month with Blue Origin's first all-women team. Yes, you read that correctly. Our editor-at-large is out of this world. This article is by Shelby Copeland. Of all the heights that our editor-at-large, Gayle King, has scaled over her career and life, her latest feat is certainly new territory. Gayle is going to space, and that flight is set to take off sooner than you think. Today, on CBS Mornings, the team shared Gayle's space trip is scheduled for April 14. Watch the full clip here. Gayle will be one of the 6 members joining Blue Origin's all-female flight team to space. The CBS team shared during the talk of the table last month. Gayle got choked up during the announcement. I'm so afraid, but I'm so excited. I just thought, what a unique opportunity. Gayle explained that she agreed after she met her crewmates yesterday, and once she got the blessing of her friends and family, including Oprah, who told her, if you don't do it and see everyone come back so excited, you will be kicking yourself. Gayle says she's honored to even be asked to be part of this new adventure, but she admits that this wasn't a long-time dream of hers. You're talking to someone who doesn't even ride on roller coasters, she tells Oprah Daily.
I had to think really hard about this decision, and I consulted family, friends, doctors, and people who I know who have gone to space. It was a decision she didn't take lightly, but ultimately made, and now she and the team are already in the thick of planning. This trip will be the aerospace company's 11th human flight in its new Shepard program, and the 31st in its history. Star Trek actor William Shatner, journalist Michael Strahan, and Amazon Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos were among some of the past passengers to take flight. Truthfully, Gail shares that she is still scared of what being out of this world literally will be like, but she decided to move forward despite her feelings. For Gail, who recently celebrated her 70th birthday, that means tapping into both courage and faith. I think about the wonder of it all and what kind of message this will send to show that an all-woman group is fearless enough to do this. And I also think of my grandchildren. My 3-year-old grandson, Luca, loves all things space, and he'll get to see me go to space, and that's really exciting for me, Gail says. Stay tuned here for more updates on Gail's flight. Again, in culture and news, TV and movies, at 73, Abbott Elementary's breakout star proves success only gets sweeter with age. William Stanford Davis's 40-year journey to playing Mr. Johnson is the later-in-life success story we all need to hear. This article is by Charlie Burlock. In a world saturated with 30 under 30 lists, wunderkind tech CEOs and tween-aged superstars, William Stanford Davis's story offers a much-needed reminder that dreams come with no expiration date, and talent only accumulates with the years. Today, the 73-year-old actor is recognized on the street and at award ceremonies for his portrayal of Mr. Johnson, a conspiracy-spouting custodian with an eclectic past and a heart of gold on Abbott Elementary. Davis landed the part, his first role as a series regular in his 40-year acting career, at the age of 70. "This was something that changed my life," he said, of the 24-time Emmy-nominated series. "It really changed my life. I caught up with the actor after a long day on set for the show's fourth season. The office-style mockumentary is often described as feel-good, and it is, but it is also so much more than that. Set in an underfunded Philadelphia public school with an all-black student body, the sitcom presents something so rare as to be revolutionary on mainstream media. Black children, and being treated as such by the eye of the camera and the adults on screen alongside them. The kids on Abbott are often funny, but never the butt of the joke, and rarely even the focal point of the plot. That burden falls on the adults of the show, the teachers and administrators and fan-favorite custodian, each with their own outrageous personality and antic-fueled plotline, but all with the same goal of nurturing and educating their beloved students. I went to a school just like Abbott in the 50s and 60s, says Davis, who grew up in St. Louis and transferred to his first integrated school in the fifth grade. Not much has changed, and that's disappointing, but the one thing I've always said is that we may have had hand-me-down books and materials, but we didn't have hand-me-down teachers, and Abbott is a display of that. Davis is grateful to the show for giving educators the respect they deserve and, of course, for giving him the recognition he so long chased. But after decades of smaller roles and, he admits, a lot of rejection, he is still bashful in the limelight. "I hope I'm not giving you any weird answers," he confesses, smiling sheepishly. He did not expect Abbott to be his big break when he auditioned. In fact, he did not expect anything from his audition at all. By that point in his career, he no longer waited by the phone or badgered his agent for updates on a particular role. He had learned to show up, do the work, leave it there, and move on. So, when a few weeks after auditioning over Zoom, his manager, who also happens to be his wife, who is an excellent manager, told him he booked the job, he didn't know what she meant. "I said, what job?" She said, "The job about the school." I said, "What school?" That's how much I had trained myself to kind of let it go. Relinquishing expectations is not the same thing as relinquishing hope. He lived and continues to live by life rules attributed to Duke Ellington. Rule number one, never quit. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. He set his sights on acting at the age of 7 when he saw Sidney Poitier fill up the silver screen in The Defiant Ones with his grandmother. A decade or so later, through the federally funded Upward Bound program, he got to see the Negro Ensemble Company perform when he was a high schooler in St. Louis. "I'd barely seen any black folks on stage like that," he recalls, "and that kind of sealed the deal for me. I wanted to move people like they moved me." In 1984, he moved to L.A. to chase his dream at full throttle. His car caught fire on his second day in the city, destroying everything he owned. He pushed on, undaunted. "I had some lean days, but I just felt in my heart that something great is going to happen. Not something good, something great." He secured his first acting credit, ironically enough, playing a version of the role that would, nearly 3 decades later, make him a star. A janitor. He appeared on 2 episodes of The Bold and the Beautiful. He kept booking jobs, few of them named, even fewer of them recurring. A pawn shop owner in 2 1999 episodes of Time of Your Life, dry cleaner in a 2012 episode of The Big Bang Theory, old man in a 2019 episode of Light as a Feather. Those lean days turned into lean years, during which he supplemented his acting income with odd jobs, telemarketing and bricklaying, and short-order cooking or a truck stop. He was working as a limo driver when he got a call to pick up a passenger at Disney Studios at a building held up by stone statues of the 7 dwarves. Before he came out of the door, "I swear it just seemed like this light came out before him," Davis remembers. And when he came out of the door, everybody there kind of backed up because this was a little different. A different sort of energy. Sidney Poitier slid into the back seat of the limo. Davis couldn't help himself. He pulled out his flip phone and tried to surreptitiously dial his mother, keeping his hands on the wheel and phone pressed under his left ear. Then came the booming, iconic voice from the back right seat. "Driver, can you please get off your phone?" He got a second chance to make a first impression with Sidney Poitier at Los Angeles's prestigious Actors Studio, an organization of which both men were members. They spoke actor to actor, and Poitier offered Davis some appreciated words of encouragement. Davis was still 2 decades away from landing his role on Abbott. After viewing the show's trailer, Davis knew that the sitcom was going to be something very special. But he also knew better than to conflate the show's success with his own. Mr. Johnson was originally written as a guest star, and Davis had played small parts in big shows his whole career. People didn't exactly recognize him on the street as Chulu Porter, the pastry chef from season 10, episode 3 of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and that role even came with a first name and a one-on-one scone-baking scene with Larry David. He arrived on the Abbott set prepared to do his job, hoping to not knock over any furniture and expecting to leave with a thank you very much and see you guys maybe on another set or something. But over the course of the first season, his natural charisma and deadpan delivery won over the hearts of cast and audience members alike. Halfway through the first season, Quinta Brunson, the show's creator and star, mentioned that they were thinking of making Mr. Johnson a series regular. "I walked away from her because I couldn't believe what she was saying," he told me. "I was like, I don't want to hear that, because you're thinking, maybe she's messing with me. There's going to be some sort of disappointment." Still, he couldn't resist telling his wife manager the news. We both kind of started crying at the thought of it, and then when it was finalized, we really started crying. Davis called me from his home in L.A., where he sat in front of a fireplace, its mantle crowded with trophies. Among them is 2022 Screen Actors Guild Award. Sidney Poitier took home his own version of the Bronze Statuette, a 1999 Lifetime Achievement Award, rather than Davis's outstanding performance by an ensemble in a comedy series, but a SAG Award all the same. It's tempting to ask Davis what he has his eyes on next, how he plans to accelerate his success after so many years of biding his time and putting in the work. But Davis isn't accelerating. He's finally coasting.
I'm enjoying every second, he told me. I'm on a great ride right now, and I'm going to have as much fun and do as much as I can for others while I'm on this ride. He's going to keep on riding, he said, with a broad grin, until the wheels fall off. We're on the word of the week, learned helplessness. When you're repeatedly beaten down, it's hard not to give up hope. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Learned helplessness. Have you ever tried fixing a bad situation, fighting to revive a stale marriage or escape a toxic job, only to hit roadblocks at every turn? Eventually, you become numb to the situation and simply give up. This is learned helplessness, internalizing that you don't have control in difficult scenarios. When there's a lot of hardship and failure in the rearview mirror, a person gives up on improving their present situation, even when they have the capacity to do so, shares Olivia Verhulst, LMHC, PMH-C, licensed psychotherapist and adjunct professor at NYU. Not to be confused with weaponized incompetence, when someone uses their supposed lack of skill or understanding to duck out of their responsibilities, learned helplessness is more about quitting when times get tough, because your brain is conditioned to think there's no other way out. The term was first coined in the late 1960s by psychologist Martin Seligman, that's S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N. He found that dogs who were repeatedly exposed to inescapable shocks eventually stopped trying to get away. In humans, learned helplessness can take many forms. It could be a high school student who keeps failing their tests, so they start to believe that studying is pointless. Or someone with a history of addiction becomes convinced that sobriety is impossible after years of trying and failing to stay in recovery. Whatever the scenario, learned helplessness can stem from anxiety and depression, and feed it, too. It impairs people's ability to feel in control of their lives. It harms their self-efficacy and can decrease self-esteem and motivation, adds Verhulst. But just as this is a learned behavior, you can also unlearn a feeling of helplessness. Positive self-talk will set you on the road to recovery, as is cultivating a sense of resilience. Because you, just as you can condition yourself to feel helpless, you can train yourself to feel optimistic, too. Over in Lifestyle, What Sandals Taught Me, the newly reimagined chain gives luxury vibes while sacrificing none of the all-inclusive fun. This article is by Chris Mitchell. I had never considered going to a sandals resort, in no small part because I am old enough to remember the commercials from the 80s and 90s, which haven't aged well. So when I went to the new Sandals St. Vincent and the Grenadines, it was with limited expectations. But despite my gimlet eye, I realized that this all-inclusive resort solves one of the nagging issues of our modern times. There's a saying that time is the greatest luxury. I would say avoiding transactions is strong competition. We live in an age where everything requires a tap or a swipe, and every purchase, even self-serve ones, implores you to add a tip. So spending a week fixed from this tyranny where you don't have to sign for anything is pure heaven. We landed on a direct JetBlue flight from New York's JFK Airport. After a quick taxi ride, our real transfer to the resort was by boat, where we were met on the dock with welcome drinks and a staff serenade. It's a white lotus touch that makes for a memorable arrival. The 301 Room Resort, which opened in 2024, has 11 restaurants, 6 pools, and countless activities, from pickleball lessons to snorkeling. It's nestled in a valley between magnificent pitons far deeper than it is wide. This lends a lush tropical vibe that most Caribbean beachfront properties lack. And while the beach frontage isn't massive, the designers have made the most of the cove, with overwater villas, a vaulted ceiling lunch spot,
a raised promenade that leads to multiple restaurants, and a two-tiered pair of crescent pools, all sharing space with the white sand beach. Behind the beach is a straight path to the 300-foot length main pool, flanked by villas, the five-story hotel buildings, and a central square where the coffee shop, gift shop, and more restaurants. This piazza might be the heart of the place, where at night the music pumps, couples boogie, and morning headaches are made from free-flowing rum drinks. This is not a vacation for introverts, as the number and concentration of guests really encourage interaction. But for the socially inclined, it is a welcoming and friendly respite from real life, where swim-up drinks count as an activity too. There is a definite party feel, and the main pool DJ only enhances that, whooping up the daytime crowd with games and prizes. There's also, to be fair, a quieter side, in fact, a literal quiet pool, where lazing in the sun with a book is about as rowdy as it gets. As for the food, there is a degree of ambition here, with an impressive Japanese restaurant and an open-fire Indian-influenced family-style concept. There's a first for the resort chain sharing space with more traditional, but quite good, seafood and steakhouse options. In the end, the location is gorgeous, the service attentive and kind, the accommodations tasteful and well-designed, and the amenities plentiful. You're unlikely to confuse the rowdy crowd with that of a traditional four-star resort. It's a little more Royal Caribbean than Ritz-Carlton. Whether you find that annoying or refreshing is probably the ultimate litmus test on whether Sandals is for you. Over in Oprah's Favorite Things, we have Gooey on the Inside Cookie Gift Set. It's $49 at Amazon. This New York-based cookie shop has spent a decade perfecting these crunchy on the outside, delicious, soft, centered jumbo cookies. Chocolate chip chunk, red velvet, and more. Their name says it all. It's also available at gooeyontheinside.com. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.